This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Protests are erupting on college campuses around the country this month as students call for racial and social reforms. Things came to a head at the University of Missouri-Columbia last week when the system president and the university chancellor resigned after mounting tension. Students at many other campuses are demanding other resignations and conducting sit-ins, hunger strikes, and walkouts as they wait for their universities to respond to their concerns. These heated confrontations are raising questions about the role of the university in supporting its minority students and what free speech on college campuses really means. Clarence Page is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who wants to help campuses open up conversations about race and inclusion. He's a senior member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board who recently moderated a campus town hall at the University of Michigan. He's going to be in the area tonight to host a similar town hall on the UNC Chapel Hill campus, but first he joins us on the State of Things. Clarence Page, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. What's happening in college? What has your attention on college campuses these days?
Well, they all do, all of the campuses, that is. And what strikes me right away is being a child of the 60s, who remembers very well, I was on campus in the 60s, truth be told, and it is a very similar kind of an atmosphere, except what's interesting to me is that the issues aren't as stark as they were back then, you know, because in the late 60s, right after the Civil Rights Bill, Voting Rights Act, were passed, there were riots going on in about 400 different cities across the country there from 65 to 69, with the Vietnam War going on, the war on poverty. So the issues aren't as stark now as they were then, but they're very real when it comes to diversity on campus, which is much broader and wider, I'm happy to say, than it was in the 60s. There are more students of color, more students who have disabilities or have a variety of ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds. What still continues is a sense of alienation on the part of a lot of students who don't come from a traditional background, and a sense on the part of many that they're more like tenants than owners of the college experience that they're having, and that there are a lot of what some people would call politically incorrect gestures, others would call racist. And I'm thinking here in particular of fraternity boys who go and put on blackface for Halloween. Not just boys, I have to say, but there have been incidents on campuses around the country, and this is not a new thing, uproars over students having parties and at Halloween time, white kids dressing up in blackface or dressing up as Indians or as Mexicans or, you know, stereotypical costumes, this sort of thing. That caused an uproar at Yale, just putting out a memo advising people not to do it.
Well, I guess if we take those two examples, Yale, where you have administrators advising people not to do that because it is racially offensive. In other words, they've shown a sensitivity toward this, something that emerged from all of those protests in the 60s, greater consciousness, greater awareness, and therefore a sense of responsibility on the part of administrators. Then you go to Mizzou on the other side, where apparently students are hurling racial epithets on the campus, on stages, in very public venues, creating what African-American students felt was a menacing atmosphere, another kind of public speech. This brings into tension what we call free speech, right? Does an administrator have a right to tell you what costume to wear? Is that politically correct? On the other hand, do I have a right to a safe environment? And is hearing those epithets unsafe for me at Mizzou? How do you balance those?
Yeah, well, those are very good issues, and they're issues that aren't limited to college campuses. As a pundit, I deal with them all the time in the so-called real world. But a situation like it at Yale, a woman administrator who put out wrote an op-ed piece intellectually arguing against the sentiments of the memo that was advising students about a proper way to dress, and then she was castigated and harassed, and students demanding that she be fired or lose her university housing. And of course, at Mizzou, you had video of a communications/journalism teacher who yelled at a student photographer, telling him to get off of the quad where students had pitched tents and set up their own little tent city there, saying the students deserve to have their space. And the and of course, the photographer said, "I've got First Amendment rights," which is also true, was public property and all. And resolving these things. I think I'm advising people to lower the volume a bit and look at what's actually going on. I mean, I'm a committed First Amendment zealot, but also after some 40 years of journalism, I know there's a difference between covering a story and getting involved in the story. And there on that quad there that day, what you can see on YouTube now, that was a situation where the students weren't openly demonstrating. They were trying to have their own meeting to assess their own success after the president of the university had resigned, along with the chancellor. And that was a situation where the photographer found himself becoming the story, but just by being there was disrupting the story that was going on. So these are judgment calls that have to be made on the spot. But folks looking on from a distance go and say, accuse one side of being anti-free press and the other side of being racist, and that doesn't get us anywhere. We really need to calm down and talk this out.
Is there a distinction to be made between the things that students do and say, which may be offensive and possibly even menacing to some extent if you're the recipient of these things, but that they're what students do, an official policy of the university, and sort of in staging a conversation or a forum on these things in which some ugly things might be said. I wonder if there's any distinction to be made there.
Well, I think we have to, first of all, the university is not necessarily responsible for what students say, but the university is responsible for having an atmosphere conducive to study, conducive to students, faculty, other members of the community getting along, and not feeling suspicious or fearful of each other or resentful of each other. We also have situations like the open mic town hall planned for this evening. For example, you have a situation where I like to establish a safe zone as far as free speech is concerned, that people can express their questions or their concerns or their vision of the future without having to worry about being castigated for being politically incorrect if they go and call someone, an Indian instead of Native American or vice versa. I mean, these things can get awfully complicated. And what strikes me about the whole political correctness debate is, did the individual intend to offend or not? In most of these cases, that are the most controversial, there was no intent. There was no intention to offend. Yet somebody found that what they had said or done had offended others, and they aren't given a chance to take it back, or they are treated punitively rather than in a more of a quiet counseling or discussion situation, where both sides get to air their concerns. That's what we really need to work on, and I'm trying to urge people, whether they're university officials or ordinary students or whatever, to back off the punitive approach, not to be so intent on punishing people for something, and let's take an educational approach. Let's talk about why are certain expressions offensive and other ones aren't.
And is there anything to be gained? I mean, you talked about this business of intent, and then, of course, the conversation in which, maybe the individual who uttered that statement didn't realize it or intend it, and then sees the harm it's done, whether they intended it or not. I mean, is that the thing you're talking about, that this builds consciousness, awareness, and makes a change without punishing
That's
the individual?
Right. Yeah, in many cases. Well, like take the N-word, for example. There are numerous cases of white students offending black students by using the N-word, and the white student says, "Well, I hear it on hip-hop records all the time." And yeah, that's true. Those are records by black hip-hop artists. There's this unwritten but strictly enforced rule about who can use the N-word and who can't. Frankly, as a black father, I'm against the N-word, and I advise my son not to use it, and other folks, just to avoid any confusion. If it's not right for white folks to use it, why should we be using it? That's one way of simplifying matters. Now, other people can disagree. Or take the case of Huckleberry Finn, one of my favorite examples, because one of my favorite books, Mark Twain, is one of my role models. Huckleberry Finn uses the N-word over 400 times. There are schools that have banned it for that reason. There is an alternative G-rated version of the book that's been published where the N-word is replaced with other euphemisms. But to me, the power of the N-word was what Twain had in mind. I mean, there's so much a part that's wrapped up in this. The book is a very humanitarian and abolitionist and pro-equality book that was really aimed at the kind of people who normally skip these sort of discussions. And that's what's so ingenious about it. By using the N-word as much as the book does, it sounds very natural and unintimidating for racists or for those people who need to hear the other side on that story. So I've been a real big defender of Mark Twain over the years. And I think this is the kind of, that's why I say we need an educational rather than a punitive approach.
Clarence Page, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Clarence Page is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and senior member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. He's going to be hosting a town hall meeting about race and inclusion on the UNC Chapel Hill campus tonight at 5:30. You can find out details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we talk about wealth, security, and asset building in North Carolina and why it's so hard to get in the Tar Heel State. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned.